Well, I thought it was in your plus week. That's next week according to the schedule. So this week it's yoga. After the Bhagavad Gita last week. Now everyone's heard of yoga, and some people do it. But it's, so today we're going to look at the, some foundational concepts of yoga. Just one more. So alongside the ideas of world renunciation that we looked at last time and the time before, and liberation and the transmigration, do you remember the two models of, that I presented of the Vedic model of going to the other world, the Pitri Loka, and then the Preta Loka, and then the Pitri Loka, and then the Vishve Deva, you merge in with the old gods. And the Upanishads try to say, okay, well, you come back as rain and you get back into... they introduce this notion of reincarnation. We looked at that and those different models. Yoga is linked in to this idea of liberation. There's a whole sort of constellation of ideas, really. And we get this idea of renunciation leads to liberation and methods or technologies which can lead out of the world of suffering. So yoga is a response. There are various responses of how this moksha, how this liberation is obtained. And in theistic traditions that we've looked at, like in the Bhagavad Gita, we've got this idea of liberation through grace. And in non-theistic traditions, we've got liberation through sustained effort of detaching the self from entanglement in the world. And through meditation and asceticism, which leads to a state of gnosis, jnana. And this method comes to be known as yoga. Now, yoga derives from yuj, from the root Sanskrit yuj, which means to control or yoke or unite. And yoga is a practice designated to control the senses and mind in order to transcend the ego, the ahankara. And yoga in generally contains the following ideas, which I've got listed in that handout. So it's the idea that consciousness can be transformed through focusing on a single point, ekagrata. So the transformation of consciousness eradicates limiting mental constraints such as greed and hate through concentration. And yoga is a discipline or range of disciplines constructed to facilitate that transformation. That's basically it. And consciousness, or chitta, which is the process of being aware, hello, come in, determines the reality or world that beings experience.
Surely the door open.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just in case anyone else comes. So you've got the idea of chitta. As is the chitta, so is the loka. So there's this relationship between consciousness and the world. And that's the transformation of consciousness entails the transformation of world as well. So chitta and loka are connected to each other. So through concentration, through ekagrata, through focusing on a single point, ekagra, you achieve this transformation.
Transformation to another world, is that
what you're
saying? Sorry, I just missed it. Sorry.
What that means varies. So some traditions would say, that means this world,
yes.
Seen as it really is.
Mm-hmm.
but some would say there are other worlds, that you change your consciousness, you go into other worlds. Yes. So at one level, it's if you feel good, then the world, happy place sort of thing. But it means more than that in the yoga traditions. It means that you change your consciousness through yogic methods and techniques. You go into a state of samadhi, and then you experience other worlds. A bit like the Buddhist notion of the jhanas. It's the same fundamental idea, really. I think we might look at the Buddhist notion of the jhanas in a minute later today. So the textual origins, those are the basic concepts of yoga. And the consciousness takes on the qualities of its objects.
Cheers.
Your consciousness takes on the qualities of its objects, and that's also a Greek idea. So the form of consciousness takes on the form of its objects. And yeah, there's two more. Sorry. So if its consciousness has focuses on pure objects like a mantra, then that raises the level of awareness, if you like. But if consciousness is focused on an impure object like gambling or something, then it takes on those sorts of qualities: greed, hate, and delusion. Now, the textual origins. The origins of yoga may be very ancient, and there are various Indus Valley seals that we looked at the first week of these lectures, which perhaps indicate a yogic posture, the Pashupati seal, if you remember, the cross-legged horned figure. Now, it could be just somebody sitting cross-legged, but it's a very cold posture. But it could be, some people think that it indicates an ancient origin of yoga. Now, the shamanas, who again we talked about some weeks ago, developed yoga. And the term yoga first appears in the Upanishads. So the shaman tradition, like Buddhism and Jainism, they develop kinds of yoga, the Ajivikas. And the term yoga is actually, it is used in the Pali canon, in the Theravada Buddhist scriptures, the term yoga is used. And its origins first appear in the Upanishads within the Hindu, the Brahmanical traditions. And the Brahmanas, the ancient Brahmanas, bear witness to ascetic practices, the tapas, and the Veda Samhitas contain some reference to ascetics, particularly the Muni, the silent one, or the Kaishin, the one with long hair, Kaishin him, and also a group called the Vratyas, those who have taken the observance or the vow, the Vrata, who seem to be fairly early ascetic wandering groups. The Vratyas are an interesting bunch, and they may have been associated with warrior brotherhoods wandering around at that early period. And we're not really sure who they were, really, the Vratyas. But perhaps they practiced kinds of, they seem to have practiced certain kinds of asceticism, and perhaps they practiced yoga. There seems to be an early reference to yoga in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and I've got the text is on your handout there, 4.4.23. So this is quite an early Upanishad. And this is Olivelle's translation, and I've given you the text there as well. About this self, one can only say not, na iti, 1880. He is ungraspable, agrihya, for he cannot be grasped. He is undecaying, for he is not subject to decay. Yes, we're just getting the gathering them up here. There's also this one, but I've only got one left, so you have to share that for now. Yeah. Now he is ungraspable, for he cannot be grasped. I'm just reading out the Brihadaranyaka passage. He has nothing sticking to him, for he does not stick to anything. This is the Atman. He is not bound, yet he neither trembles in fear nor suffers injury. These two thoughts do not pass across this self at all. Therefore I did something bad, and therefore I did something good. This self, on the other hand, passes across both those. He is not burnt by anything that he has done or left undone. So the self is completely detached from entanglement in the world, in its true nature. He says the same point is made in this Rig Vedic verse. He is a Brahmin's eternal greatness. He is not made greater or smaller by action. It's his trail that one should get to know. And when a man knows him, he is no longer stained by bad deeds. Now that's a verse from the Rig Veda that doesn't exist, so it could have been made up by the redactor of the text, or perhaps he had access to a version of the Rig Veda that we no longer have access to. A man who knows this therefore becomes calm, composed, cool, patient and collected. He sees the self in just himself and all things as the self. Evil does not pass across him, and he passes across all evil. He is not burnt by evil, he burns up all evil. He becomes a Brahmin, free from evil, free from stain, free from doubt. He is the world of Brahman, the Brahman Loka, Your Majesty, and I have taken you to him, so said Yajnavalkya. So that's an interesting passage. You seem to get the idea of knowledge of the self is important here, but you also get the idea of being composed and calm and patient and collected, which are characteristics of yoga, so perhaps indicating some yogic type practice. And also transcending good and evil, transcending good deeds and bad deeds. And that the self is beyond action, is outside of action. And you also get here the Brahma Loka, the idea of the world of the absolute, the Brahma Loka. Which comes to mean something different later on. It comes to mean one, not liberation, but one of the heavens. So that's an early reference, not to the word yoga, but to the idea that the self is known through calmness and control and composure, patience. The Katha Upanishad, you get the steady control of the senses. And in the Katha also you get the story of death and Nachiketas, which I don't have for you, I'm afraid, but you probably know the story. It's Nachiketas comes back and from studying the Veda, and he's full of arrogance and pride, and his father says, "Go to death," or something like that. His father is angry with him, tells him to go to death. So the son goes to the abode of death. But when he gets there, there's nobody there. He knocks on the door and he can't get in. So he sits outside and waits. And 3 days later, Yama, the god of death, comes back and says, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry to keep you waiting all this time." And Nachiketa says, "No problem." And he says, "I will grant you three boons, three gifts for keeping you waiting." And the first, if I remember, is that his father isn't angry with him anymore. please don't let my father be angry with me anymore. And the second is knowledge of the sacrifice. And the third is knowledge of immortality, if I remember, something like that. And death is willing to grant the first two, no problem, but he doesn't. He's reluctant to grant the third. But yet Nachiketa is insistent on this. And he grants him that boon, so he goes back to his father with this knowledge. Now that's related to yoga in the sense of there's this sort of journey to the other world, to the world of death, and that yoga is the practice which prepares you for that death. I don't remember the textual details. Do you remember them?
More or less.
It's something like that. So that's an interesting story. Yoga also could, of course, have much more ancient origins and shamanic idea of the journey to the other world in shamanism. Nick Allen here has done some work on this in a comparative Indo-European context. So this idea of a journey to another world is fundamental to a proto-Indo-European myth, which is possibly reflected in the practices of yoga and the idea of journeying to another world. So in the Odyssey, the journey of Odysseus to the underworld is reflected in stories in India as well of journeys to the other world, like Nachiketa here. So it could be a fundamental proto-Indo-European story about journeying to the other world and returning. And that idea is picked up in the concept of yoga as well. Another source for yoga is the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, which is a late text, possibly written about the same time as the Bhagavad Gita. And it's a kind of Shaiva Bhagavad Gita, I sometimes think. So it's a Shvetashvatara, the teachings of White Mule, the Shveta, the Ashvatara, the thing like a horse, which is white. But it's the Shvetashvatara is the name of the sage. And you've got that in front of you. This is the from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. So it's talking about sages. They yoke their minds, they yoke their thoughts. Those inspired poets of the sorry, who's cut off there? So, what does it say? Of the Vedas. That one alone who knows the pattern has apportioned the offerings and is sounding the praise of the god Savitri. I yoke with adoration the ancient formulation of you too. Sorry, let's forget all the earlier stuff. Let's go to verse 8. This is the important section here. When he keeps his body straight with the three sections erect, he draws the senses together with the mind into his heart, and the wise man shall cross the frightening rivers with the boat consisting of that formulation of that Brahman. So there you've got a classical example of yoga, yogic posture, the body straight, the three sections of the body erect. And you bring your senses together with the mind into your heart. And through that you cross the frightening river of samsara. Brahman here, the formulation, it perhaps means, it could mean a sound formula, could mean a kind of proto-mantra, perhaps. Anyway, the next bit, compressing his breaths. and curbing his movements, a man should exhale through one nostril when his breath is exhausted. A wise man should keep his mind vigilantly under control, just as he would that wagon yoked to unruly horses. Again, that same image from the Bhagavad Gita. So compressing your breath. So again, yogic pranayama, breath control. So there's a link between body, breath, and mind, or consciousness. You still the body, and you still the breath, and therefore you still the mind. So you still the body through asana, through posture, you still the breath through pranayama, and you still the mind through concentration. And as you control a wagon or a ratta or a chariot, you control the senses. So the horses are like the senses going out into the world all the time, and you bring them under control through the practice of yoga. So he goes on, level and clean, free from gravel, fire and sand, near noiseless running waters and the like, pleasing to the mind but not offensive to the eye, provided with a cave or a nook, shelter for the wind. In such a spot should one engage in yogic practice. And in verse 11, mist, smoke, sun, wind, fire, fireflies, lightning, crystal moon, these are the apparitions that within yogic practice precede and pave the way for the full manifestation in Brahman. That's quite interesting. It seems to refer to sort of inner visions, if you like, obtained through yogic practice. And not dissimilar to Theravada Buddhist practice, the early Buddhist practice, you get similar kinds of phenomena. Where they talk about the development of a sign or a nimitta, which is supposed to take you into the first level of meditation. So here you've got a similar idea, that you have these inner visions. And then eventually you will break through that, through the mist and the sun and the fire and the inner light, into the full manifestation of the Absolute of Brahman. And then it goes on, when earth, water, fire, air, and ether have arisen together, and the body made, what is that? Made up of these five, becomes equipped with the attribute of yoga. That man, obtaining a body tempered in the fire of yoga, will no longer experience sickness, old age, and suffering. So it's that idea of immortality through, indeed, the prolongation of the body, through a body cooked in the fire of yoga. And one of the ideas is that it's not just physical immortality. Somebody once told me, a yogi once told me, that it was the idea of keeping the body going as long as possible so that you can attain liberation in this lifetime. But I suspect that there's also this idea of physical immortality was in their minds. And you do get some of these yogis living to extraordinarily long old ages. So Shivapuri Baba? That Alan Bennett wrote about. There's a good book called Long Pilgrimage by Alan Bennett, who was one of Gurdjieff's followers, about this 19th century yogi Shivapuri Baba, who, so it says, has lived to about 140, but whether who knows? They've got photographs of him in this book. He's probably about 65 or something. Yeah. But he made Queen Victoria, this character. Anyway, if you do this, then you get lightness, health, and absence of greed, a bright complexion, pleasant voice, a sweet smell, very little feces and urine. That is to say, that is the first working of yogic practice. Just as a disc smeared with clay, once it is cleaned well, shines brightly, so also an embodied person, once he has perceived the true nature of the self, become solitary, his goal attained, and free from sorrow. So it's a very early, very clear statement about yoga, yogic practice, the yogic body, and the consequences of yoga. You also get the early sources, the Maitreya Upanishad, where there's a king, Brihadratta, he performs tapas by staring at the sun with his arms up for 1,000 days. And he's visited by enlightened ascetics who teach the king a six-faceted yoga, which is breath control, withdrawal of the senses, meditation, concentration, inquiry and samadhi, absorption. So these are precursors to the eight-limbed yoga of Patanjali. But there's also, the Bhagavad Gita chapter 6 is devoted to yoga. And then the later the tradition develops the yoga of Upanishads from about 100 BC to 300 CE, where you have again breath control, inner vision. And particularly interesting here, you get the development of the yoga of inner sound, nada or shabda, nada yoga, shabda yoga, which goes into later traditions, the Sant tradition of the Punjab, for example. And the emphasis on the inner sound, the Radha Swamis and all those other groups who focus on the God is an inner sound that you perceive with your inner ear. You've heard of the third eye, there's a third ear as well. So those are later developments. And related to this, the Yoga Tattva Upanishad mentions four kinds of yoga: mantra yoga, repetition of mantras, Laya Yoga, the dissolution of the universe within the body, Hatha Yoga, the yoga of force, and Raja Yoga, the kingly or the best yoga, the royal yoga. Now Hatha Yoga becomes particularly important in the later Middle Ages and in early modernity. So Swatmarama's Hatha Yoga Pradipika describes various complex asanas that we practice to this day. And you also get the idea of developing of yoga as a non-method. Amanasika yoga, the mindless yoga, the yoga that is effortless and without mental effort and energy, just the awakening, the sudden awakening to the truth of liberation.
Which one's that? Sorry.
The Amanasika yoga.
Amanasika.
And there's some early texts on this yoga. But let's go back in time. Let's look at Patanjali's yoga philosophy. So the classic statement is the systematization of yoga in the Yoga Sutras composed between 100 BC and probably about 500 CE, sometime during that period. Patanjali. And he develops the eight-limbed, or the best, the Ashtanga, or the Raja Yoga, the yoga of kings. It represents a codification of knowledge and ideas and practices that have probably been developing for many centuries. And it's a very good summary of yoga, the first 4 to 6 verses. Now the teaching about yoga, Atta Yoga Anushasanam. And this is a classic definition of yoga. Yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations, Yoga Chittavritti Nirodha. So yoga, nominative singular for the Sanskritists among you, is the chittavritti nirodha, the nirodha, the cessation of the chittavritti, the fluctuations of the chitta, of the mind or of consciousness. Now if that happens, tada drashtu svarupi vastanam, then tada, the self abides in its own nature. Then there is the avastanam, the abiding svarupe in its own nature, its own form, drashtu of the self, of the one who sees, the seer, the drashtri, the seer. So if the mental fluctuations stop, then the seer abides in his true nature, in his own nature. Vritti sarupyam itaratra. Otherwise, there is vritti sarupyam conformity to the vrittis, to the fluctuations of the mind. If that doesn't happen, then the mind then there's conformity to the fluctuations. Then the self conforms to the fluctuations. Well, it's not really the self that conforms, because the self is beyond the vrittis, but there is apparent fluctuation to the to apparent conformity to the fluctuations. And what are these vrittis? There are five kinds of vrittis tending towards harm, klishta or aklishta or non-harm, and these are valid cognition, pramana, misconception, viparyaya, conceptualization or imagination, vikalpa, sleep, nidra, and memory, smriti. Now, all of these are usual activities of the mind. Everything that we usually think about as our activity, conscious activity, is classified by Patanjali as a fluctuation of vritti, which the yogi needs to transcend. Even pramana, even cognition, even valid cognition, the pramanas are within the realm of the vrittis. Now, to transcend vrittis, you develop, potentially develop this eight-limbed yoga, probably coming out of the six-limbed yoga. And there are these eight aspects which I've got listed here. There's ethics or restraint, the yamas. The yamas and the niyamas. The yamas are the don'ts, and the niyamas are the do's, really. So the yamas are non-violence, ahimsa, telling the truth, not stealing, celibacy, brahmacharya, and not being greedy. And the niyamas, the do's, are cleanliness, shaucha, serenity, tapas, austerity, study or recitation of the Veda, and devotion to the Lord. And that's interesting that you should get that.
And you define tapas as
austerity, or it literally means heat. Mm.
When you say devotion to the Lord, it's a Lord of your choosing, right? In Patanjali's yoga system, it's not a particular...
It's, Ishvara, yeah. It is a particular... it's very strange that you should get that, because the metaphysics behind this is Sankhya, which is, has no Ishvara, is an Ishvara, has the self and matter. And that's the metaphysics that Patanjali assumes. But he introduces a theistic dimension, this Ishvara, as an object of consciousness. So the Ishvara is a self, like all the others, but seems to have some... is a bit more important than the other Ishvaras than you are. He doesn't say much about Ishvara, does he?
I would say it's an ordinary self, ordinary Purusha, except the fact that he was never involved with this world, this Prakriti. That's the only difference, in fact.
Yeah, that's the only difference.
So call it God. I don't think it's a.
It's not quite
in,
God.
In early yoga, it's not proper. I think.
It's not the creator of the universe. It's not the sustainer of the universe. It's another Purusha like you or me. But a pure Purusha who's never been entangled in the world.
Ever liberated, I would say. Ever liberated Purusha.
Ever liberated Purusha, ever liberated Purusha.
So what's a Purusha?
A self. Yeah. And ever liberated.
And that's the definition here of the Lord.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
So it's a Lord. He's another self like you or me, but was never entangled in the world. And seems to be an object of consciousness at some point in meditation or something. So Eliyahu, I think, or somebody argues that, these yogis are coming upon something in their yogic practice, their meditation, and this is what it is. This is how they've understood it. Yeah. This Ishvara, this self, as an object of meditation.
And we should meditate on him because we have an example before us we should reach.
Yes, that's right. It's the goal. The liberated self. Yeah. He's an example of liberated self that I want to be.
So we have some proof that it's possible, the liberation. At least one soul is really liberated.
So. At least one soul is liberated. Yeah. Yes. So there's hope for us all. Yeah. And you do that through... it's interesting that devotion, that with Pranidhana, it's difficult. I mean, does that what it means, devotion? I mean, the focus or concentration on this Ishvara. And you do that through, there's the eight limbs, there's the restraint, yama, the niyama, these practices of cleanliness, serenity, and so on, shaucha, which came to be interpreted in Hatha Yoga as various bodily practices, like cleaning the head or the nose with water, drinking water in through the nose and spitting it out through the mouth. And swallowing a cloth, bringing it out, cleaning the insides. I was in Vienna, actually. I was in a cafe in Vienna. I met this bloke who was a yogi, and he said he could drink a pint of or a liter or something of water through his nose, which he then proceeded to do. It's a complete conversation stopper. It's very impressive.
Coming out of the ear too.
Oh, probably. Yeah. He didn't do that, this guy, but I'm sure he probably would have been able to.
That did he swallow it?
Yeah, he swallowed it through his nose. Yeah. Drank some water through his nose. I was very impressed. But didn't make it come out of his ears. But so that's his next 10 years of practice would be trying to achieve that. So you get asana, which is posture, fixing the body in a still position. Then once the body is still, you get breath control, pranayama, as it indicated in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad that we read earlier. Blocking one nostril, breathing in, breathing out through the other nostril, or whatever it is. Sense withdrawal, pratyahara, as a tortoise brings itself into its shell, so the senses withdraw from the world. In later tradition, they speak about the nine doors of the body, so the nine orifices of the body, that the senses, the attention spreads out into the world through the nine orifices, and you have to bring them back in and focus on the tenth door, the Dvadashanta, which is the between the eyes. Focus on the point between the eyes. Concentration. Dharana, meditation, dhyana, and samadhi. These are dhyana, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. To my mind, it's not precisely clear what they all mean. So I think you have to be a yogi to really properly appreciate them. But they're degrees of concentration, degrees of meditation. Dhyana is in Buddhism jhana, and that later on comes to mean visualization. But these are levels of concentration. And samadhi, which is absorption, concentrated absorption in a different state of mind, is divided by Patanjali into sampragnata and asampragnata. Sampragnata means with the support of objects of consciousness, and asampragnata is without the support of any objects of consciousness. So sampragnata is divided into four levels: initial thought, vitarka, sustained thought, vichara, joy, ananda, and the sense of I, asmita. Now, these are really taken from Buddhism. Theravada, early Buddhism, had a direct influence on this, where you've got these levels of meditation.
I don't know if you've done any of this, but you've got
jhana is the Pali for dhyana, and there you've got these five jhana factors: vitaka. Vitaka is throwing the mind onto an object of concentration, and vichara is keeping it there. So
Think of a green apple. That's vitaka, the evoking it in the mind. Vichara is trying to keep the green apple in your mind, not being able to. So those are two processes of cause, and this is goes into the this is the same terms for the in the Patanjali uses.
Vitaka is keeping it on. Did you say?
Yeah.
Keeping it on. Yeah.
Yeah. According to the Buddhist tradition, anyway, vitaka vitaka. And that gives rise to piti, joy, and then sukha, contentment, happiness, and then ekagrata, one-pointedness, ekagrata in Sanskrit. And they're all present in the first jhana. And then you refine these into other jhanas, 1, 2, 3, 4. In the fourth jhana, you only have ekagrata. And this seems to be directly equivalent to the... it kind of maps onto Patanjali's yoga system, but this is a much older system than Patanjali. Because the Buddha got enlightened from the fourth jhana, of course. So he went up through the jhanas and then got enlightened from the fourth jhana. And then beyond that, these are the rupa jhanas, and then the arupa jhanas beyond that, which seem to map onto the asampragnata samadhi of Patanjali. But
sorry, that's the R.
The arupa formless.
Oh, the formless.
Formless jhanas. And these correspond to the arupa loka, or lokas, and the rupa lokas. And these are all beyond this world. This world is the karma loka, the world of desire. So a very early yogic model, which seems to influence directly the Yoga Sutras.
And this is in the Theravada Buddhism. And then also from the, again, with referring to Buddhism, from the fourth jhana, you can develop the magical powers, the abhinyas. The six abhinyas, one of which is iddhi, siddhi, one of which is magical powers. So in book 3 of the Yoga Sutras, he talks about the siddhis, the ability to become small as an atom, levitation, the ability to expand without eating, the all pervasiveness, irresistible will, control over the natural elements, power to create, and the fulfillment of desires. And these are parallel to the Buddhist abhinyas. So the iddhis in the abhinyas. Also, understanding the sounds of creatures by concentrating on the distinction between word and... Also, understanding the sounds of creatures, and there's this idea of concentrating on the distinction between word and meaning. I don't quite understand that, to be honest, that siddhi.
Sorry, this is in Patanjali.
Yes, this is in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra Book 3. There's a knowledge of others' mental states, but not their objects. Thus, Vyasa tells us that we can know a person is in love, but not the person who he or she is in love with. So you can tell, there's a kind of telepathy, but you don't know the objects, according to Vyasa.
Vyasa is... Are we back to the Bhagavad Gita?
Oh, he's a commentator on the...
On the Patanjali.
There's a commentary on the text.
Yeah.
Attributed to this fellow called Vyasa, just means the compiler, really. So.
Yeah.
And the object, the goal, the ultimate goal, is Kaivalya, liberation. Now, according to David White, in a very stimulating book, which I haven't read properly, just glanced at, but it looks very interesting, it argues that the object of the purpose of yoga was siddhi, it was magical powers from a very early date. But certainly there's a strong rhetoric of liberation, that liberation is the goal. And this liberation occurs in the context of Samkhya metaphysics. So it's the goal is to know this state of kaivalya, this state of isolation, where the soul, the spirit, is isolated from matter in itself. It's a bit like Leibniz's monads or something. Self is contained in itself. And so we read at 115, detachment is the perception of the subduing of the thirst for objects which are seen or described. So the self no longer thirsts after objects of experience and is content in itself, isolated in itself. So the Samkhya view of liberation, which Patanjali seems to take on board, is that there are innumerable selves, and Ishvara is just another one, which are all isolated in their own little worlds, as it were. Once they're free from apparent entanglement and prakriti in matter. And he says that to the discriminating ones, i.e. the yogins, all is suffering. And with the transformations of the painful latent tendencies, the yogis are beyond suffering if they're liberated. So, Ishvara is an object of contemplation. So it's often translated as God, but I think it's probably right. It's probably not quite an accurate rendering, because it's not the creator and sustainer of the universe. It's another soul, it's another Purusha. A special kind of Purusha, untouched by klesha, untouched by affliction, untouched by action, and untouched by the results of action.
Is this far depicted in any kind of form, or is it just an abstract notion of it is actually represented as a deity?
Oh, no, it's just an abstract notion.
Just an abstract notion, okay.
Just an abstract notion, yeah. And how do we know about this Ishvara? The Vyasa, this commentator, says we know about it through scripture. Shruti, scripture is the proof. And then what is the proof of scripture? Supreme wisdom, he says. Vidya. So the later yogic tradition, this is the basis of yoga. The later yogic traditions developed various other kinds of yoga, like mantra and kundalini, it becomes very ornate, very elaborate. But the basic idea of yoga is contained in the Yoga Sutras, I always think, in those first four verses, that yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations. It's a very good definition.